Again, this is Brad Crandall with Monitor 67, where you keep your finger on the pulse of the weekend world. In 2 minutes, we'll hear how things might have been if there had been psychiatrists in the days of the American Revolution. Comedian Bob Newhart doing the imagining. First, Monitor Music. Here's Tony Bennett.
Grab your coat and get your hat. Leave your worries on the doorstep. Life can be so sweet on the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear the pitter-pat? And that happy tune is your step. Life can be complete on the sunny side of the street. I used to walk in the shade with those blues on parade. But I'm not afraid, because this rover crossed over. And if I never had a cent, I'd be rich as Rockefeller, with gold dust at my feet, on the sunny side of the street. I'd be rich as Harry Belafonte, with Harry Goldwater at my feet.
Next, Monitor on Stage. Star performances recorded live in leading nightclubs, theaters, and concert halls around the country. Here, comedian Bob Newhart imagines what it might have been like to be a psychiatrist in the days when Benjamin Franklin was alive.
Yeah, who is it, Murray? Ben Franklin. Can I duck him, Mary? He's standing right there in the office. He's dripping all over the rugs. All right, send him in, Mary. Mary, how's he doing on his account? 3 months behind, huh? Yeah, he's thrifty, all right, Mary. All right, send him in. Well, hi there, Ben. How are you today? Good. Ben, you want to lie down on the couch there? Ben, you want to put some papers down on the couch so don't get the couch all wet. Well, I'd say from the looks of our clothes, we've been flying the kite again in the rainstorm, right? Okay, Ben, we copied on our dreams, did we? Hmm? You didn't have to. Same one. You're walking down the street, and you find a half dollar, and your face is on it. That's pretty sick, Ben, you know that? Washington has the same dream, only he sees his face on paper. You want to give George my number, Ben? Ben, we don't seem to be getting anywhere with a kite thing. Let's switch to something else. How are the inventions coming along, Ben? You got lucky this morning. You don't have to wear your bifocals anymore. The lightning fused your glasses to your eyeballs. what are you going to call them, Ben? Contact lenses. Ben, I sure would like to be more optimistic about your condition, but afraid I'm going to have to recommend a shock treatment, Ben. I don't like to do it because there are always undesirable side effects. Well, what we do, Ben, is we stick you inside the Liberty Bell and ring it a couple times. Huh? Well, the problem is you quiver for about 2 or 3 years, you see. Ben, I'm afraid our time is almost up. We'll see you next Thursday, then. Right. Goodbye, Ben. You get him, Mary? He ran out already, huh?
Maybe that's why Mr. Franklin called himself Poor Richard. Bob Newhart, monitor on stage. Moving forward in time now, but not quite to the present. Here's Julie Andrews to sing her latest Thoroughly Modern Millie.
There are those, I suppose, think we're mad. Heaven knows the world has gone to wrath and to ruin. What we think is chic, unique, and quite adorable. They think he's odd and fun and amorable. But the fact is everything today is thoroughly modern. Check your personality, everything today makes yesterday slow. Better face reality, it's not insanity, said Vanity Fair. In fact, it's stylish to raise your skirts and bob your hair. Rumble seat, the world is so cozy. If the boy is kissable and that tango dance they wouldn't allow, now it's quite permissible. Goodbye, good goody girl, I'm changing and how. So beat the drums, cause here comes thoroughly modern Millie now.
The time, 17 minutes after the hour, and in just a few minutes more, we'll hear about the difficulties of American vice presidents who've had to take over the presidency. So, stay right with us. You're on the Monitor Beacon.
Dr. Joyce Brothers is the answer to your problems. Weekdays at 9 on the Big Voice of Big Town USA, WNBC, New York. USA, focal point of the world, place of people, place of greatness, whose environs encompass the totality of today, headquarters of the United Nations, of the world of communications, center of the arts, Big Town, USA, place of action, holding forth its promise of now, making each moment alive. And WNBC, the big voice of Big Town, communicates these living moments to you.
Brad Crandall here for Monitor 67, traveling through the weekend world with news, sports, features, and music. Here's Jack Jones to sing Afterthoughts.
Lingering, whispering afterthoughts, catching at my sleeve like the autumn leaves blowing in the rain. Not that I'll admit I'm the least apprehensive, just pensive, wondering in vain. Did I say enough, tell enough, well enough? And in spite of all, now that I recall, were we ever through? And are these the thoughts I must always pursue? Or haven't you afterthoughts too?
This Friday just passed marked the anniversary of one of the great tragedies of American history, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, 16th President of the United States. The difficult task of taking over his duties fell to Andrew Johnson. The problems of such a takeover of presidential power form the subject matter of a new book by Michael DeSalle, former governor of Ohio and a student of political history. The name of the book is Second Choice, and Monitor's Betty Grobley talked with Mr. DeSalle about it.
Of these second choices, which do you think has made the most impact, or an impact worthy of some mention here?
Well, actually, all of the men who succeeded the presidency made impact. You know, we often get the feeling, and it's just a common misapprehension, that the vice president is really nothing. But the men who succeeded the presidency, in many, many cases, have improved on their predecessors or have done excellent jobs.
What about Andrew Johnson?
Andrew Johnson stepped in, I suppose, at the most difficult time in American history, succeeding Abraham Lincoln, who had not been a popular president and who had just squeaked through to re-election in 1864. And so Johnson stepping in at a time when Lincoln had come from a very low ebb to a very high position in the nation. At this time, the Union had been preserved. The Union forces had been successful. And Lincoln's assassination just put him forward in the minds of people to a point where he was almost an irreplaceable hero. Here comes Andrew Johnson, whose background had been rather undistinguished. He'd been a good governor of Tennessee, had been a good U.S. senator. He had fought to preserve the Union. But he was a Democrat brought into a Republican administration by the circumstances of Lincoln's death. The Republicans who controlled the Senate and the House at that time were all for revenge. They didn't care for this policy of reconciliation. At that time, they were expressing the feeling of the American people. The American people had lost a great deal during that war. There were many lives had been lost. A great deal of money had been expended. And the war was not a popular war. You know, we make a great deal of the fact now that people are burning their draft cards. During the Civil War, people were burning down the draft headquarters in New York. They weren't just fooling around with draft cards. They were doing it in a big way. So the war was not a popular war. And the result was a feeling of vengeance on the part of people. When Andrew Johnson stepped in Lincoln's shoes, he attempted the same policies. He wanted conciliation. His motives were even more suspect than Lincoln because he was a Southerner. He was from Tennessee, and people thought that he was going to just return the Union to the people who had lost the war. And the men in the Senate were strong. They were pretty able. They were vengeful. They were out to do what they could. They wanted a Republican in the presidency, and Ben Wade of Ohio was then the president pro tem of the Senate and in a position to succeed. And then the story is told that during the time that this impeachment trial was going on, Mrs. Wade, who had already selected her inaugural gown and who had been making provisions for her relatives to come in for the inauguration, was sitting in the Senate gallery watching the proceedings, and Ben Wade, who had been in the position to succeed, was presiding. So A lot of factors. Johnson seemed to be inept. He made a tour around the country and was booed by the people who were out to get him.
We forget, don't we?
Demonstrations were being conducted wherever he appeared. He'd lose his temper and lash out at his enemies, and he was accused of being intoxicated at the time because, unfortunately, at the time he was inaugurated. As vice president, he had been drinking a little too much, and his speech
showed it.
He slurred his words, and his statements were very unfortunate and undiplomatic at the time because he was looking down at other people who had tried to take advantage of him. So all of this combined put Andrew Johnson in a very difficult position. But I'm not too sure that Lincoln could have coped with the climate of the nation at the time. He had not been a popular president, and it wouldn't have taken much to push this feeling back into the into the foreground.
Well, fascinating book by a fascinating man, all about the vice presidency. It is called Second Choice by Michael DeSalle. And now this is Betty Grobley in Washington for Monitor.
Child Singers with Little by Little and Bit by Bit, dedicated to all of those who still haven't finished filling out their income tax returns. It was kind of nice of the government, though, to extend the deadline until tomorrow. However, I wish to offer a deal to the government. You keep the deadline the same and extend the deductions, okay? Thank you. This is Monitor, yours to enjoy at home or take along in your car, wherever you go in the USA. In the area of Steubenville, Ohio, and Weirton, West Virginia, our friends hear us on station WEIR. Right now, let's take a roll call of all our NBC stations, and then we'll be back. I'm Brad Crandall. This is Monitor, for the sounds of spring in the air, on the NBC Radio Network. Once again, Brad Crandall here for Monitor 67. In less than 2 minutes, we'll hear from psychologist Dr. Joyce Brothers reporting on one aspect of the age-old battle of the sexes. First, Monitor music. Here's Andy Williams with a musical love letter to The Face I Love.
Just think of things like daffodils and peaceful sheep on clover hills, the morning song of whippoorwills, and you'll see the face that I love. Think of any old sky getting ready to cry. Down comes the rain, but it's raining confetti. And think of things like far-off isles, to blue-green eyes and sunlit smiles, and in your hand a wishing star, the one you thought too far above. Every lovely view introduces you to the face I love.
The face you love may be the face of your husband or your wife, but even love doesn't prevent men and women from arguing about which one works harder. Can the question ever be solved? Well, maybe. At least Dr. Joyce Brothers has some scientific information on the subject.
It seems that one of our society's oldest arguments concerns the question of who works harder, the housewife or her husband. I know that many husbands can't understand why their wives look exhausted at the end of the day. After all, it's the husband who did the breadwinning. And his wife is just as convinced that while she's been slaving over the proverbial hot stove, her husband's had a chance to get out in the relaxed, glamorous business world. The argument has gone on as long as it has, because each side has plenty of factual ammunition. There must have been 100 magazine articles pointing out all the different jobs a woman is expected to hold down. Chambermaid, babysitter, cook, nurse, dishwasher, chauffeur, and so forth. And the husband can always point to the death rate. The men seem to work themselves to death. Their average lifespan is shorter than their wives, and they get almost all the ulcers. Well, Dr. Herman K. Hellerstein, a heart specialist at Western Reserve, decided to find the truth. He measured the comparative energy expended by housewives and their husbands throughout the day. And the results show that the decision in this argument must go to the women. The average housewife does spend more energy on her domestic chores and caring for the children than her husband does on his job. The energy consumption of both men and women were measured against the energy consumption of the body when it's at rest. Some of the men listening aren't going to like this, but the study found that a man with a desk job used only 1.5 times the energy of the resting person. That means only half again as much energy as he would use if he were sound asleep. The factory worker puts out about 2.2 times as much energy as when he's dormant. That's still fairly low. Just as an aside, I'd like to mention that this helps explain why many recovered heart patients are still able to meet the energy demands of their job in our modern society. Anyway, the housewife scored high above her husband in energy output. It varied greatly from woman to woman, but the whole group was generally harder working than their husbands. Of course, this doesn't take into account nervous strain and other pressures, but in the area of work, the woman is the winner of this old argument. This is Dr. Joyce Brothers for Monitor.
Oh, I agree. You know, women do work harder, trying to convince their husbands that they do work harder. Dr. Brothers, incidentally, appears each weekend on Monitor. Here are the Sinatras, father and daughter, with their current hit, Something Stupid.
I know I stand in line until you think you have the time to spend an evening with me. And if we go someplace to dance, I know that there's a chance you won't be leaving with me. Then afterwards we drop into a quiet little place and have a drink or two. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you. I can see it in your eyes that you despise the same old lies you heard the night before. Though it's just a line to you, for me it's true and never seemed so right before. I practice every day to find some clever lines to say to make the meaning come true. But then I think I'll wait until the evening gets late and I'm alone with you. The time is right, your perfume fills my head, the stars get red, and oh, the night's so blue. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you. Your perfume fills my head, the stars get red, and oh, the night's so blue. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you. I love you.
This is Monitor, the time 17 minutes before the hour. Ahead, music by Jimmy Dean and Lana Cantrell, and some observations by space expert Peter Hackus on the lessons to be learned from the tragedy of Apollo 1. So stay tuned. You're on the Monitor Beacon.
Life's more fun with Chateau Martin Burgundy wine, the wine that makes good dinners great. Rich, smooth dinner wine with the pleasantly dry, velvety flavor. A new delight, sip after sip. Mellow to perfection in 100-year-old oak casks.
I am rich about the Chateau Martin wine. A lovely treat, delicious when you dine. Sparkling Burgundy on ice. Try it once, you try it twice. You'll be nuts about the Chateau Martin wine.
We hope you have a wonderful wine. Chateau Martin wine.
And when you do, you'll agree with Gaston.
I am nuts about your Chateau Martin wine.
A product of Chateau Martin Wines, New York. Makers of famous Chateau Martin blackberry wine. Had any lately?
WNBC, New York. The big voice of Big Town USA is the sound of people.
Brad Crandall back with more of Monitor 67. Starting off this quarter hour with Jimmy Dean singing Sweet Misery.
Oh, when I'm lonely, I think of someone. Someone I call sweet misery. In her arms I was in heaven. But heaven wasn't meant for me. Ooh, I still love her. But I lost her. When she walked out, the hurt walked in. Now our love's gone.
just like an old song that no one ever wants to hear again. I count heartaches that a big fool makes, and I think about my sweet misery. I do my sorrow each new tomorrow. Who's they ain't never been a bigger fool than me?
Tragedy of the Apollo spacecraft stunned the American public, and the investigation of it has been exhaustive. But what steps are being taken to ensure against a repetition of this appalling mishap? Space expert Peter Hackus reviews the lessons of Apollo 1 and speculates on the changes it may bring in our space program.
Now that the original shock of horror and the shock of disbelief have been a bit time-tempered, it might be useful to take another look at the Apollo tragedy. In the light of what has been uncovered by the lengthy NASA investigation and at congressional hearings, one gets the feeling at times that with all the problems brought out, it would have been miraculous if Apollo 1 had ever made a successful flight. NASA officials have talked of messy tangles of wires aboard the capsule, of stray parts and a tool left inside. They've been critical of the capsule maker, North American Aviation, complaining about improper design and specifications, about sloppy quality control over parts and workmanship, and about the poor assignment of authority at North American, which NASA people have said was just too spread out to get the job done. All of this is no doubt valid criticism as viewed with 2020 hindsight. But the fact remains, it would seem, that the ultimate responsibility must rest with NASA. NASA, after all, is an agency of the people, as is any other government bureau, and it's charged with spending the taxpayers' money in the wisest way possible. It should have been up to NASA, it seems to me, to guarantee strict supervision of the job North American was doing. And if there was sloppiness and other deficiencies, NASA inspectors stationed inside the North American plant and at Cape Kennedy should have spotted them as the work progressed. On paper, at least, the NASA management system was outstanding. But in actual practice, NASA management obviously wasn't able to supervise North American management. No doubt there will be a fine against the capsule maker called an incentive penalty. They've already begun firing certain inspectors and other personnel. But this kind of punishment has to be accompanied by a new management approach, or it won't do the trick. Neither at NASA nor at North American is there room for lackadaisical leadership, management more interested, for example, in building empires than in building spacecraft, or management at any level which doesn't have visibility into the very entrails of the Apollo program. This coming week, we'll see the launch of another surveyor vehicle to soft land on the moon, scoop up some of the surface material and study it to help pick out landing sites for Apollo astronauts. Also this next week, the many studies of the Apollo 1 tragedy will end, and the team will get to work once again. A still grieving, sadder, but much wiser nation can only hope the lessons learned will be impressive ones, and that the tragic deaths of three astronauts may have saved the lives of countless others. Peter Hackus, NBC News, Washington.
A special report on the problems of safety in manned spaceflight. Now, more Monitor music, the voice of Lana Cantrell with A Man and a Woman.
Then they must hold each other tight, oh so very tight, and take a chance that in the light, in tomorrow's light, they'll stay together. So much in love. And in the silence of the mist, of the morning mist, when lips are longing to be kissed, where there is reason to resist and deny a kiss that holds a promise of happiness. Though yesterday still surrounds you with a warm and precious memory,
and a woman. Well, there's two deductions right there, in case you're still making out your income tax. If you've already finished, then I guess you can just sort of relax and sit back and enjoy the music of Morton Gould and the orchestra as they play Georgia Girl. This is Monitor 67, and I'm Brad Crandall, reminding you that NBC News on the Hour is just ahead.
This is the NBC Radio Network.